Hey folks, Attorney Andrew Branca here for the Law of Self-Defense. Welcome to our ongoing reading of the famous U.S. Supreme Court decision, Miranda v. Arizona, which of course gave us all the Miranda rights that are so familiar to us today from TV and the movies. That decision was handed down in 1966. And we're going through a four-part reading of Miranda v. Arizona. This is the third of those parts. So the first two parts were the first half and second half of the majority opinion. Now we start on the dissents. This was a 5-4 decision, as close as you get with the U.S. Supreme Court. And the four dissenting justices combined in various combinations to write three dissenting opinions. In this part 3 of 4 of our reading of Miranda, we covered the first of those two dissents. And dissents are really important, folks, because they give you the other side of the argument. If there's no dissent and you read an opinion, you're only reading the winning side of the argument, not the losing side. And of course, the losing side, just because it lost, doesn't mean it doesn't have legal merit. Here we have four Supreme Court justices disagreeing with the majority about Miranda rights. So we're going to read the first two of the three dissents in this part 3, and then we'll read the last dissent in part 4. But this is part 3 of 4 of our reading of Miranda v. Arizona. Enjoy. Today's show is sponsored by the Law of Self-Defense, specifically our advanced live online class taking place on April 20th, 2024. This is our full day course on use of force law that makes you hard to convict if you're ever compelled to use force in defense of yourself, your family, or your property. We cover everything you need to know, why and how the legal system prosecutes self-defense, the 5 elements of self-defense, the fundamental building blocks of any claim of self-defense. We cover defense of others and defense of property, consciousness of guilt, self-defense immunity. We spend almost an hour talking about interacting with the police in the aftermath of a use of force event, how to craft your own customized, legally sound self-defense strategy, and much, much more. Now, we only teach this class twice a year at most. So if you miss this April course, it'll be at least 6 months before you have the opportunity to take this course again and make yourself hard to convict. Do you know when you're going to be attacked? It's not up to you. The bad guy chooses the time, place, and manner of attack. You need to be ready for both the physical fight and the legal fight before that happens. And register now, and you can get up to 50% off for this April 20th Law of Self-Defense live online advanced course. Don't hesitate. Scan that QR code now or simply visit lawofselfdefense.com/advanced. Now, there are several dissents in this decision written by different combinations of justices where they agreed on some points, didn't agree on other points. And the dissents are always interesting in court cases because they provide us with the opposing side of the argument. Often, you always, of course, have the majority opinion that's written out, so you know how the winning side was thinking, but often you don't know how the losing side was thinking. And when we have a dissent, that's effectively the losing side giving us the counter argument. So we start with the first of the dissents here, this one written by Justice Clark, who agreed with the majority opinion in part and disagreed in part, hence his contribution to this dissent, Justice Harlan and Justice White. So 3 justices dissenting in this variation of the dissent. And they're referring here to numbers 759, 760, 761, and concurring in the result in 584. These are all different cases. So this U.S. Supreme Court decision didn't involve just the defendant Miranda. There were other cases that had similar factual and legal questions. And so the Supreme Court dealt with all of those in the Miranda decision. Miranda was just one of those, hence Miranda v. Arizona. Miranda, of course, came out of Arizona. That's where the event occurred, the state of Arizona, which had said there were no such things as Miranda rights. They don't have to read a defendant their rights, advise them of the right to counsel, and so forth. So it was a state case that got bumped up to the U.S. Supreme Court because of these broader constitutional questions about whether or not you need to be informed of your rights before you're subject to interrogation. So starting with this first dissent, it is with regret, writes Justice Clark, and agreeing with him, Harlan and White, it is with regret that I find it necessary to write in these cases. However, I am unable to join the majority because its opinion goes too far on too little. While my dissenting brethren, the other dissenting justices, do not go quite far enough. nor can I join in the court's criticism of the present practices of police and investigatory agencies as to custodial interrogation. The materials it refers to, meaning the majority refers to, as police manuals are, as I read them, merely writings in this field by professors and some police officers. Not one of these is shown by the record here to be the official manual of any police department, much less in universal use in crime detection. Moreover, the examples of police brutality mentioned by the court are rare exceptions to the thousands of cases that appear every year in the law reports. The police agencies, all the way from municipal and state forces to the federal bureaus, are responsible for law enforcement and public safety in this country. I am proud of their efforts, which in my view are not fairly characterized by the court's opinion. The ipsa dixit, that's Latin for dogmatic and unproven statement, of the majority has no support in our cases, our precedents of the U.S. Supreme Court. Indeed, the Supreme Court admits that, quote, we might not find the defendant's statements here to have been involuntary in traditional terms, close quote. In short, the court has added more to the requirements that the accused is entitled to consult with his lawyer and that he must be given the traditional warning that he may remain silent and that anything that he says may be used against him. Now, the court fashions a constitutional rule that the police may engage in no custodial interrogation without additionally advising the accused that he has a right under the Fifth Amendment to the presence of counsel during interrogation, and that if he is without funds, counsel will be furnished him. When at any point during an interrogation the accused seeks affirmatively or impliedly to invoke his rights to silence or counsel, interrogation must be foregone or postponed. The court further holds that failure to follow the new procedures requires inexorably the exclusion of any statement by the accused, as well as the fruits thereof. Such a strict constitutional specific inserted at the nerve center of crime detection may well kill the patient. Since there is at this time a paucity of information and an almost total lack of empirical knowledge on the practical operation of requirements truly comparable to those announced by the majority, I would be more restrained, lest we go too far too fast. Section 2. Custodial interrogation has long been recognized as, quote, undoubtedly an essential tool in effective law enforcement, close quote. Recognition of this fact should put us on guard against the promulgation of doctrinaire rules, especially is this true where the court finds that, quote, the Constitution has prescribed, close quote, its holding, and where the light of our past cases is to the contrary. Indeed, even in Escobedo, this Escobedo is a previous case 2 years prior to this, where the court said that defendants have to be informed of certain rights. Even in Escobedo, the court never hinted that an affirmative waiver was a prerequisite to questioning, that the burden of proof as to waiver was on the prosecution, that the presence of counsel absent a waiver during interrogation was required, that a waiver can be withdrawn at the will of the accused, that counsel must be furnished during an accusatory stage to those unable to pay, nor that admissions and exculpatory statements are confessions. To require all those things at one gulp should cause the court to choke over more cases, which it expressly overrules today. The rule prior to today, as Mr. Justice Goldberg, the author of the court's opinion in Escobedo, stated it in Haynes versus Washington, depended upon a totality of circumstances evidencing an involuntary admission of guilt. And he concluded, quote, of course, detection and solution of crime is, at best, a difficult and arduous task, requiring determination and persistence on the part of all responsible officers charged with the duty of law enforcement. And certainly we do not mean to suggest that all interrogation of witnesses and suspects is impermissible. Such questioning is undoubtedly an essential tool in effective law enforcement. The line between proper and permissible police conduct and techniques and methods offensive to due process is, at best, a difficult one to draw, particularly in cases such as this where it is necessary to make fine judgments as to the effect of psychologically coercive pressures and inducements on the mind and will of an accused. We are here impelled to the conclusion from all the facts presented that the bounds of due process have been exceeded. Close quote. Section 3. I would continue to follow that rule. Under the totality of circumstances rule, of which my brother Goldberg spoke in Haynes, I would consider in each case whether the police officer prior to custodial interrogation added the warning that the suspect might have counsel present at interrogation, and further, that a court would appoint one at his request if he was too poor to employ counsel. In the absence of warnings, the burden would be on the state to prove that counsel was knowingly and intelligently waived, or that in the totality of the circumstances, including the failure to give the necessary warnings, the confession was clearly voluntary. Rather than employing the arbitrary Fifth Amendment Rule 4, which the court lays down, I would follow the more pliable dictates of the due process clauses of the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments, which we are accustomed to administering and which we know from our cases are effective instruments in protecting persons in police custody. In this way, we would not be acting in the dark, nor in one full sweep, changing the traditional rules of custodial interrogation, which this court has for so long recognized as a justifiable and proper tool in balancing individual rights against the rights of society. It will be soon enough to go further when we are able to appraise with somewhat better accuracy the effects of such a holding. I would affirm the convictions in Miranda v. Arizona, case number 759, Vignera in New York, case number 760, and Westover v. United States, case number 761. In each of those cases, I find from the circumstances no warrant for reversal. In California v. Stewart, case number 584, I would dismiss the writ of certiorari for want of a final judgment. But if the merits are to be reached, I would affirm on the ground that the state failed to fulfill its burden in the absence of a showing that appropriate warnings were given, of proving a waiver or totality of circumstances showing voluntariness. Should there be a retrial, I would leave the state free to attempt to prove those elements. So that was the first dissent. The second dissent is written by Justice Harlan and joined by Justice Stewart and Justice White. Harlan writes, I believe the decision of the court represents poor constitutional law and entails harmful consequences for the country at large. How serious these consequences may prove to be, only time can tell. But the basic flaws in the court's justification seem to me readily apparent, now once all sides of the problem are considered. Part 1. Introduction. At the outset, it is well to note exactly what is required by the court's new constitutional code of rules for confessions. The foremost requirement, upon which later admissibility of a confession depends, is that a fourfold warning be given to a person in custody before he is questioned, namely, that he has a right to remain silent, that anything he says may be used against him, that he has a right to have present an attorney during questioning, and that if indigent, he has a right to a lawyer without charge. To forego those rights, some affirmative statement of rejection is seemingly required, and threats, tricks, or cajolings to obtain this waiver are forbidden. If before or during questioning the suspect seeks to invoke his right to remain silent, interrogation must be foregone or cease. A request for counsel brings about the same result until a lawyer is procured. Finally, there are a miscellany of minor directives. For example, the burden of proof of waiver is on the state. Admissions and exculpatory statements are treated just like confessions. Withdrawal of a waiver is always permitted, and so forth. While the fine points of this scheme are far less clear than the court admits, the tenor is quite apparent. The new rules are not designed to guard against police brutality or other unmistakably banned forms of coercion. Those who use third-degree tactics and deny them in court are equally able and destined to lie as skillfully about warnings and waivers. Rather, the thrust of the new rules is to negate all pressures, to reinforce the nervous or ignorant suspect, and ultimately to discourage any confession at all. The aim, in short, is toward voluntariness in a utopian sense, or to view it from a different angle, voluntariness with a vengeance. To incorporate this notion into the Constitution requires a strained reading of history and precedent and a disregard of the very pragmatic concerns that alone may on occasion justify such strains. I believe that reasoned examination will show that the due process clauses provide an adequate tool for coping with confessions, and that even if the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination be invoked, its precedents taken as a whole do not sustain the present rules. Viewed as a choice based on pure policy, these new rules prove to be highly debatable, if not one-sided, appraisal of the competing interest, imposed over widespread objection at the very time when judicial restraint is most called for by the circumstances. Section 2. Constitutional premises. It is most fitting to begin an inquiry into the constitutional precedents by surveying the limits on confessions the court has evolved under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. This is so because these cases show that there exists a workable and effective means of dealing with confessions in a judicial manner, because the cases are the baseline from which the court now departs, and so serve to measure the actual as opposed to the professed distance the court travels from precedent, and because examination of the precedents helps reveal how the court has coasted into its present position. The earliest confession cases in this Supreme Court emerged from federal prosecutions and were settled on a non-constitutional basis, the court adopting the common law rule that the absence of inducements, promises, and threats made a confession voluntary and admissible. While a later case said the Fifth Amendment privilege controlled admissibility, this proposition was not itself developed in subsequent decisions. The Supreme Court did, however, heighten the test of admissibility in federal trials to one of voluntariness in fact, and then by and large left federal judges to apply the same standards the Supreme Court began to derive in a string of state court cases. This new line of decisions, testing admissibility by the Due Process Clause, began in 1936 with Brown v. Mississippi, and must now embrace somewhat more than 30 full opinions of the Supreme Court. While the voluntariness rubric was repeated in many instances, the court never pinned it down to a single meaning, but on the contrary, infused it with a number of different values. To travel quickly over the main themes, there was an initial emphasis on reliability, supplemented by concern over the legality and fairness of the police practices, in an accusatorial system of law enforcement, and eventually by close attention to the individual state of mind and capacity for effective choice. The outcome was a continuing reevaluation on the facts of each case of how much pressure on the suspect was permissible. Among the criteria often taken into account were threats or imminent danger, physical deprivation such as lack of sleep or food, repeated or extended interrogation, limits on access to counsel or friends, length and illegality of detention under state law, and individual weakness or incapacities. Apart from direct physical coercion, however, no single default or fixed combination of defaults guaranteed exclusion as evidence at trial. And synopsis of the cases would serve little use because the overall gauge has been steadily changing, usually in the direction of restricting admissibility. But to mark just what point had been reached before the court jumped the rails in Escobedo v. Illinois, the two-year case earlier to this, it is worth capsulizing the then-recent case of Haynes v. Washington. There, Haynes had been held some 16 or more hours in violation of state law before signing the disputed confession, had received no warnings of any kind, and despite request, had been refused access to his wife or to counsel, the police indicating that access would be allowed after a confession. Emphasizing especially this last inducement and rejecting some contrary indicia of voluntariness, the court in a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court, held the confession inadmissible. There are several relevant lessons to be drawn from this constitutional history. The first is that with over 25 years of precedent, the court has developed an elaborate, sophisticated, and sensitive approach to admissibility of confessions. It is judicial in its treatment of one case at a time, flexible in its ability to respond to the endless mutations of fact presented, and ever more familiar to the lower courts. Of course, strict certainty is not obtained in this developing process, but this is often so with constitutional principles, and disagreement is usually confined to that borderland of close cases where it matters least. The second point is that in practice, and from time to time in principle, the Supreme Court, has given ample recognition to society's interest in suspect questioning as an instrument of law enforcement. Cases countenancing quite significant pressures can be cited without difficulty, and the lower courts may often have been yet more tolerant. Of course, the limitations imposed today were rejected by necessary implication in case after case. The right to warnings having been explicitly rebuffed in this court many years ago. As recently as Haynes v. Washington, the Supreme Court openly acknowledged that questioning of witnesses and suspects is undoubtedly an essential tool in effective law enforcement. Finally, the cases disclose that the language in many of the opinions overstates the actual course of decision. It has been said, for example, that an admissible confession must be made by the suspect in the unfettered exercise of his own will, and that a prisoner is not to be made the deluded instrument of his own conviction. Though often repeated, such principles are rarely observed in full measure. Even the word voluntary may be deemed somewhat misleading, especially when one considers many of the confessions that have been brought under its umbrella. The tendency to overstate may be laid in part to the flagrant facts often before the court. But in any event, one must recognize how it has tempered attitudes and lent some color of authority to the approach now taken by the court. I turn now to the court's asserted reliance on the Fifth Amendment, an approach which I frankly regard as a deception. The court's opinion, in my view, reveals no adequate basis for extending the Fifth Amendment's privilege against self-incrimination to the police station. Far more important, it fails to show that the court's new rules are well supported, let alone compelled, by Fifth Amendment precedents. Instead, the new rules actually derive from quotation and analogy drawn from precedents under the Sixth Amendment, which should properly have no bearing on police interrogation. The court's opening contention that the Fifth Amendment governs police station confessions is perhaps not an impermissible extension of the law, but it has little to commend it in the present circumstances. Historically, the privilege against self-incrimination did not bear at all on the use of extra-legal confessions, for which distinct standards evolved. Indeed, the history of the two principles is wide apart, differing by 100 years in origin, and derived through separate lines of precedence. Practice under the two doctrines has also differed in a number of important respects. Even those who would readily enlarge the privilege must concede some linguistic difficulties, since the Fifth Amendment in terms prescribes only compelling any person, quote, in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, close quote. Though weighty, I do not say these points and similar ones are conclusive, for as the Supreme Court reiterates, the privilege embodies basic principles always capable of expansion. Certainly, the privilege against self-incrimination does represent a protective concern for the accused and an emphasis upon accusatorial rather than inquisitorial values in law enforcement, although this is similarly true of other limitations, such as the grand jury requirement and the reasonable doubt standard. Accusatorial values, however, have openly been absorbed into the due process standard governing confessions. This, indeed, is why, at present, the kinship of the two rules governing confessions and self-incrimination is too apparent for denial. Since extension of the general principle has already occurred, to insist that the privilege applies as such serves only to carry over inappropriate historical details and engaging rhetoric and to obscure the policy choices to be made in regulating confessions. Having decided that the Fifth Amendment privilege does apply in the police station, The majority Supreme Court reveals that the privilege imposes more exacting restrictions than does the 14th Amendment's voluntariness test. It then emerges from discussions of Escobedo that the Fifth Amendment requires, for an admissible confession, that it be given by one distinctly aware of his right not to speak and shielded from the compelling atmosphere of interrogation. From these key premises, the majority Supreme Court finally develops the safeguards of warning, counsel, and so forth. I do not believe these premises are sustained by precedents under the Fifth Amendment. The more important premise is that pressure on the suspect must be eliminated, though it be only the subtle influence of the atmosphere and surroundings. The Fifth Amendment, however, has never been thought to forbid all pressure to incriminate oneself in the situations covered by it. On the contrary, it has been held that failure to incriminate oneself can result in denial of removal of one's case from state to federal court. This is not to say that short of jail or torture, any sanction is permissible in any case. Policy and history alike may impose sharp limits on interrogation. However, the court's unspoken assumption that any pressure violates the privilege is not supported by the precedents, and it has failed to show why the Fifth Amendment prohibits that relatively mild pressure that the Due Process Clause permits. The majority Supreme Court appears similarly wrong in thinking that precise knowledge of one's rights is a settled prerequisite under the Fifth Amendment to the loss of its protections. A number of lower federal court cases have held that grand jury witnesses need not always be warned of their privilege. And the Wigmore Treatise on Evidence states this to be the better rule for trial witnesses. No Fifth Amendment precedent is cited for the court's contrary view. There might, of course, be reasons apart from Fifth Amendment precedent for requiring warning or any other safeguard on questioning, but that is a different matter entirely. A closing word must be said about the Assistance of Counsel Clause of the Sixth Amendment, which is never expressly relied on by the majority Supreme Court, but whose judicial precedents turn out to be linchpins of the confession rules announced today. To support its requirement of a knowing and intelligent waiver, the court cites Johnson v. Zerbst, appointment of counsel for the indigent suspect that's tied to Gideon v. Wainwright. The silent record doctrine is borrowed from Carnley v. Cochran, as is the right to an express offer of counsel. All these cases imparting glosses to the Sixth Amendment concerned counsel at trial or on appeal. While the court finds no pertinent difference between judicial proceedings and police interrogation, I believe the differences are so vast as to disqualify wholly the Sixth Amendment precedents as suitable analogies in the present cases. The only attempt in this majority Supreme Court to carry the right to counsel into the station house occurred in Escobedo, the court repeating several times. That stage was no less critical than trial itself. This is hardly persuasive when we consider that a grand jury inquiry, the filing of a certiorari petition, and certainly the purchase of narcotics by an undercover agent from a prospective defendant may all be equally critical. Yet provision of counsel and advice on that score has never been thought compelled by the Constitution in such cases. The sound reason why this right to counsel is so freely extended for a criminal trial is the severe injustice risked by confronting an untrained defendant with a range of technical points of law, evidence, and tactics familiar to the prosecutor, but not to the defendant himself. This danger shrinks markedly in the police station, where indeed the lawyer, in fulfilling his professional responsibilities of necessity, may become an obstacle to truth-finding. The court's summary citation of the Sixth Amendment cases here seems to me best described as, quote, the domino method of constitutional adjudication, wherein every explanatory statement in a previous opinion is made the basis for extension to a wholly different situation, close quote. Section 3, Policy Considerations. Imagined as an expression of public policy, the court's new regime proves so dubious that there can be no due compensation for its weakness in constitutional law. The foregoing discussion has shown, I think, how mistaken is the majority Supreme Court in implying that the Constitution has struck the balance in favor of the approach the majority Supreme Court takes. Rather, precedent reveals that the 14th Amendment in practice has been construed to strike a different balance, that the Fifth Amendment gives the majority Supreme Court little solid support in this context, and that the Sixth Amendment should have no bearing at all. Legal history has been stretched before to satisfy deep needs of society. In this instance, however, the court has not and cannot make the powerful showing that its new rules are plainly desirable in the context of our society, something which is surely demanded before those rules are engrafted onto the Constitution and imposed on every state and county in the land. Without at all subscribing to the generally black picture of police conduct painted by the majority Supreme Court, I think it must be frankly recognized at the outset that police questioning allowable under due process precedents may inherently entail some pressure on the suspect and may seek advantage in his ignorance or weaknesses. The atmosphere and questioning techniques, proper and fair though they be, can in themselves exert a tug on the suspect to confess. And in this light, to speak of any confessions of crime made after arrest as being voluntary or uncoerced is somewhat inaccurate, although traditional. A confession is wholly and incontestably voluntary only if a guilty person gives himself up to the law and becomes his own accuser. Until today, the role of the Constitution has been only to sift out undue pressure, not to assure spontaneous confessions. The court's new rules aim to offset these minor pressures and disadvantages intrinsic to any kind of police interrogation. The rules do not serve due process interests in preventing blatant coercion, since, as I noted earlier, they do nothing to contain the policeman who is prepared to lie from the start. The rules work for reliability in confessions almost only in the Pickwickian sense that they can prevent some confessions from being given at all. In short, the benefit of this new regime is simply to lessen or wipe out the inherent compulsion and inequalities to which the court devotes some 9 pages of description. What the court largely ignores is that its rule impair, if they will not eventually serve wholly to frustrate, an instrument of law enforcement that has long and quite reasonably been thought worth the price paid for it. There can be little doubt that the majority Supreme Court's new code would markedly decrease the number of confessions. To warn the suspect that he may remain silent and remind him that his confession may be used in court are minor obstructions. To require also an express waiver by the suspect and an end to questioning whenever he demurs must heavily handicap questioning. And to suggest or provide counsel for the suspect simply invites the end of the interrogation. How much harm this decision will inflict on law enforcement cannot fairly be predicted with accuracy. Evidence on the role of confessions is notoriously incomplete, and little is added by the majority Supreme Court's reference to the FBI experience and the resources believed wasted in interrogation. We do know that some crimes cannot be solved without confessions, that ample expert testimony attests to their importance in crime control, and that the court is taking a real risk with society's welfare in imposing its new regime on the country. The social costs of crime are too great to call the new rules anything but a hazardous experimentation. While passing over the costs and risks of its experiment, the majority Supreme Court portrays the evils of normal police questioning in terms which I think are exaggerated. Albeit stringently confined by the due process standards, interrogation is no doubt often inconvenient and unpleasant for the suspect. However, it is no less so for a man to be arrested and jailed, to have his house searched, or to stand trial in court, yet all this may properly happen to the most innocent, given probable cause, a warrant, or an indictment. Society has always paid a stiff price for law and order, and peaceful interrogation is not one of the dark moments of the law. This brief statement of the competing considerations seemed to me ample proof that the majority Supreme Court's preference is highly debatable at best and therefore not to be read into the Constitution. However, it may make the analysis more graphic to consider the actual facts of one of the 4 cases reversed by the majority Supreme Court. Miranda v. Arizona serves best being neither the hardest nor easiest of the four cases under the majority Supreme Court's standards. On March 3, 1963, an 18-year-old girl was kidnapped and forcibly raped near Phoenix, Arizona. 10 days later, on the morning of March 13th, petitioner Miranda was arrested and taken to the police station. At this time, Miranda was 23 years old, indigent, and educated to the extent of completing half the ninth grade. He had an emotional illness of the schizophrenic type, according to the doctor who eventually examined him. The doctor's report also stated that Miranda was alert and oriented as to time, place, and person, intelligent within normal limits, competent to stand trial, and sane within the legal definition. At the police station, the victim picked Miranda out of a lineup, and two officers then took him into a separate room to interrogate him, starting about 11:30 a.m. Though at first denying his guilt, within a short time, Miranda gave a detailed oral confession and then wrote out in his own hand and signed a brief statement admitting and describing the crime. All this was accomplished in 2 hours or less, without any force, threats, or promises, and, I will assume this, though the record is uncertain, without any effective warnings at all. Miranda's oral and written confessions are now held inadmissible under the majority Supreme Court's new rules. One is entitled to feel astonished that the Constitution can be read to produce this result. These confessions were obtained during brief, daytime questioning conducted by two officers and unmarked by any of the traditional indicia of coercion. They assured a conviction for a brutal and unsettling crime for which the police had and quite possibly could obtain little evidence other than the victim's identification, evidence which is frequently unreliable. There was, in sum, a legitimate purpose, no perceptible unfairness, and certainly little risk of injustice in the interrogation. Yet the resulting confessions and the responsible course of police practice they represent are to be sacrificed to the majority Supreme Court's own fine-spun conceptions of fairness, which I seriously doubt is shared by many thinking citizens in this country. The tenor of judicial opinion also falls well short of supporting the majority Supreme Court's new approach. Although Escobedo has widely been interpreted as an open invitation to lower courts to rewrite the law of confessions, a significant heavy majority of the state and federal decisions in point have sought quite narrow interpretations. Of the courts that have accepted the invitation, it is hard to know how many have felt compelled by their best guess as to this court's likely construction. But none of the state decisions saw fit to rely on the state privilege against self-incrimination, and no decision at all has gone as far as this majority Supreme Court goes today. It is also instructive to compare the attitude in this case of those responsible for law enforcement with the official views that existed when the court undertook three major revisions of prosecutorial practice prior to this case. In Johnson v. Zerbst, which established that appointed counsel must be offered the indigent in federal criminal trials, the federal government all but conceded the basic issue, which had in fact been recently fixed as Department of Justice policy. In Mapp v. Ohio, which imposed the exclusionary rule on states for Fourth Amendment violations, more than half of the states had themselves already adopted some such. And in Gideon v. Wainwright, which extended Johnson v. Zerbst to the states, an amicus brief was filed by 22 states and commonwealths urging that course. Only two states, besides that of respondent, came forward to protest. By contrast, in this case, Miranda, new restrictions on police questioning have been opposed by the United States and in an amicus brief signed by 27 states and commonwealths, not including the three other states which are parties. No state in this country has urged this court to impose the newly announced rules, nor has any state chosen to go nearly so far on its own. The majority Supreme Court, in closing its general discussion, invokes the practice in federal and foreign jurisdictions as lending weight to its new curbs on confessions for all the states. A brief resume will suffice to show that none of those jurisdictions has struck so one-sided a balance as the majority Supreme Court does today. Heaviest reliance is placed on the FBI practice. Differing circumstances may make this comparison quite untrustworthy, but in any event, the FBI falls sensibly short of the majority Supreme Court's formalistic rules. For example, there's no indication that FBI agents must obtain an affirmative waiver before they pursue their questioning, nor is it clear that one invoking his right to silence may not be prevailed upon to change his mind. And the FBI warning as to appointed counsel apparently indicates only that one will be assigned by the judge when the suspect appears before him. The thrust of the majority Supreme Court's rules here is to induce the suspect to obtain appointed counsel before continuing the interview with police. Apparently, American military practice, briefly mentioned by the majority Supreme Court, has the same limits and is still less favorable to the suspect than the FBI warning, making no mention of appointed counsel. The law of the foreign countries described by the majority Supreme Court also reflects a more moderate conception of the rights of the accused as against those of society when other data are considered. Concededly, the English experience is the most relevant. In that country, a caution as to silence, but not counsel, has long been mandated by the judge's rules, which also place other somewhat imprecise limits on police cross-examination of suspects. However, in the court's discretion, confessions can be, and apparently quite frequently are, admitted in evidence despite disregard of the judge's rules, so long as they are found voluntary under the common law test. Moreover, the check that exists on the use of pretrial statements is counterbalanced by the evident admissibility of fruits of an illegal confession and by the judge's often used authority to comment adversely on the defendant's failure to testify. India, Ceylon, and Scotland are the other examples chosen by the majority Supreme Court. In India and Ceylon, the general ban on police-adduced confessions cited by the majority Supreme Court is subject to a major exception. If evidence is uncovered by police questioning, it is fully admissible at trial, along with the confession itself, so far as it relates to the evidence and is not blatantly coerced. Scotland's limits on interrogation do measure up to the majority Supreme Court's. However, restrained comment at trial on the defendant's failure to take the stand is allowed the judge. And in many other respects, Scotch law redresses the prosecutor's disadvantage in ways not permitted in this country. The majority Supreme Court ends its survey by imputing added strength to our privilege against self-incrimination since, by contrast to other countries, it is embodied in a written constitution. Considering the liberties the majority Supreme Court has today taken with constitutional history and precedent, few will find this emphasis persuasive. In closing this necessarily truncated discussion of policy considerations attending the new confession rules, some reference must be made to their ironic untimeliness. There is now in progress in this country a massive re-examination of criminal law enforcement procedures on a scale never before witnessed. Participants in this undertaking include a special committee of the American Bar Association under the chairmanship of Chief Judge Lombard of the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, a distinguished study group of the American Law Institute headed by Professors Vorenberg and Bader of the Harvard Law School, and the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and Administration of Justice under the leadership of the Attorney General of the United States. Studies are also being conducted by the District of Columbia Crime Commission, the Georgetown Law Center, and by others equipped to do practical research. There are also signs that legislatures in some states may be preparing to re-examine the problem before us. It is no secret that concern has been expressed lest long-range and lasting reforms be frustrated by this court's too rapid departure from existing constitutional standards. Despite the court's disclaimer, the practical effect of the decision made today must inevitably be to handicap seriously sound efforts at reform, not least by removing options necessary to a just compromise of competing interests. Of course, legislative reform is rarely speedy or unanimous, though this court has been more patient in the past. But the legislative reforms, when they come, would have the vast advantage of empirical data and comprehensive study,
They would allow experimentation and use of solutions not open to the courts, and they would restore the initiative in criminal law reform to those forms where it truly belongs. Section 4, Conclusions. All four of the cases involved here present express claims that confessions were inadmissible, not because of coercion in the traditional due process sense, but solely because of lack of counsel or lack of warnings concerning counsel and silence. For the reasons stated in this opinion, I would adhere to the due process test and reject the new requirements inaugurated by the majority Supreme Court. On this premise, my disposition of each of these cases would be stated briefly. In two of the three cases coming from state courts, Miranda v. Arizona, number 759, and Vignera v. New York, number 760, the confessions were held admissible, and no other errors worth comment are alleged by petitioners. I would affirm the convictions in these two cases. The other state case is California v. Stewart, number 584, where the state Supreme Court held the confession inadmissible and reversed the conviction. In that case, I would dismiss the writ of certiorari on the ground that no final judgment is before us. Putting aside the new trial open to the state in any event, the confession itself has not even been finally excluded since the California Supreme Court left the state free to show proof of waiver. If the merits of the decision in Stewart be reached, then I believe it should be reversed and the case remanded so the state Supreme Court may pass on the other claims available to the respondent. In the federal case, Westover v. United States, number 761, a number of issues are raised by petitioner apart from the one already dealt with in this dissent. None of these other claims appears to me tenable, nor in this context to warrant extended discussion. It is urged that the confession was also inadmissible because not voluntary, even measured by due process standards, and because federal state cooperation brought the McNabb-Mallory rule into play. However, the facts alleged fall well short of coercion, in my view, and I believe the involvement of federal agents in petitioner's arrest and detention by the state too slight to invoke Anderson. I agree with the government that the admission of the evidence now protested by petitioner was at most harmless error, and two final contentions, one involving weight of the evidence and another improper prosecutor comment, seemed to me without merit. I would therefore affirm Westover's conviction. In conclusion, nothing in the letter or the spirit of the Constitution or in the precedents squares with the heavy-handed and one-sided action that is so precipitously taken by the majority Supreme Court in the name of fulfilling its constitutional responsibilities. The foray which the majority Supreme Court makes today brings to mind the wise and far-sighted words of Mr. Justice Jackson in Douglas v. Jeanette. Quote, "This court is forever adding new stories to the temples of constitutional law, and the temples have a way of collapsing when one story too many is added." Close quote. All right, folks, that's the conclusion of part 3 of 4 of our reading of Miranda v. Arizona. This is part 3, of course, the first 2 of 3 of the dissenting opinions in this case. In part 4, we'll conclude with reading the third and final dissent in this case. And I look forward to seeing all of you there. Until then, I remain Attorney Andrew Branca for the Law of Self-Defense. Stay safe.